again after 7 days away. You are listening to the 20-Minute Hit, the fastest talking sports podcast out there, as we bring you all the major talking points from the last week in the world of sport, break them down into five manageable chunks, 3 minutes on each, and then we're on to the next one. I'm Ollie Wilson, sports commentator and broadcaster for the Football League and BT Sport. And as always, I'm joined by my delightful co-host, sports journalist, Mr. Paul McDonald. Paul, you're away last week with a wedding, and this week it was, of course, your birthday. Paul, happy returns, mate. How are you doing?
Another year older, another year closer to the crypt, Ollie.
ever the cheerful one. It's I swear last week you were really dour about being back in the UK. Now you're a bit down about being older. So I'm hoping that the lively sports debate will put a smile on your face once again this afternoon. Joining us on the show today is, of course, a man who needs no real introduction. You see him all the time on Sky Sports News, and he's obviously a fantastic bloke because he's a Sheffield Wednesday fan as well. David Garrido, everybody, joining us on the show as well. David, mate, a pleasure to have you on board. How are you?
Absolutely pleasure to be on. Thank you very much. Yeah, very well, thanks. Apart from that result at Charlton at the weekend, but let's not mention that too much. Yeah, no special occasions for me. I've just come back from holiday, but that's about it.
Everybody's getting a bit of time in the sun while it's miserable and wet over here, and I'm yet to go away. So, yeah, I'm gonna jet off at some point soon, hopefully. We're going to jet straight into our first topic of discussion today because there's plenty to talk about this week. And we're going to kick things off with the huge Russian doping allegation scandal that has hit in the last couple of days or so. International officials allowing Russian athletes to compete despite suspicious drug tests. Athletes were tipped off about tests. Samples were destroyed in Russian laboratories. The World Anti-Doping Agency investigation led by Dick Pound has brought all these allegations to light. State-supported doping program is how it's been described. Has it tarnished the Olympics? Has it tarnished the IAAF, who's come under heavy criticism for their handling of this? SEBCO too has been criticised in the press recently. He says that perhaps Russia should be banned from Rio. Gentlemen, it's almost like something out of the Cold War, if you will. Are we surprised about this, the Russian doping allegations?
I don't think anybody should be surprised by it. I think this might just be the tip of the iceberg, unfortunately. I've been an advocate of kind of supporting doping measures for a long time, but when I was reading about stuff like this and research, it always in the back of my mind wasn't technically restricted to athletics. I think I always saw it expanding into many, many other sports where physicality is important. It just so happens that the Russians have been so blatant about it in this case, not only with the destroying of the doping samples before WADA officials arrived, but also by setting up another facility in synchronicity to the one that the WADA people were actually investigating. It just shows how much contempt they've got for procedure in this case. I think if this is what's happening with the Russians, and the Russians were still losing, remember, to athletes from other countries, then it raises questions about what's going on elsewhere.
But you know what? You say it's not a shock. There are still elements of this that are truly shocking, though, aren't there, Paul? I mean, you know, if you look at the number of organisations that are involved, not just WADA, the IAAF, the Russian Athletics Federation, but then we talk about, you know, the FSB, which was effectively the successor to the KGB, the Russian Security Service. Talk about the Kremlin, about Putin. I mean, like, you know, this is like a James Bond film, isn't it? I mean, it's not just because it's in Russia, but it is just a little bit nuts how it's gone this deep. And, you know, it's not just, you know, this has happened before. You know, we know about the sort of East German doping scandal from a while back and what's happened in cycling in terms of systematic sort of doping scandals. It was not just one person, but a whole collusion of people. I think the shocking thing for me is that no one has ever learned and that people are still trying to get away with it.
That naivety in my point to say that it was expected on anything. I think, yeah, the doping itself is not a surprise to me. The actual procedures and the depth and the tentacles with which it reaches into other parts of Russian culture is definitely very shocking. I think there's a few other elements here. I think that the way that the IAAF have turned a blind eye to this over the past decades of systematic cheating is thoroughly unacceptable. And I'm not one to try and tar SEBCO with this brush yet, given he's just taken over. But Co has been actively speaking fondly about Lamine Dayak, who's obviously left now following the claims against him. He spoke about him warmly, as in the same way that Blatter ironically spoke about SEBCO when SEBCO was put on the exec committee to investigate ethics about 6 or 7 years ago.
Co has said he may have been wrong for doing that now, though, as well. He has come out and said, I may have made a mistake by backing Dayak as he did.
It's easy to say that now in hindsight, but under what grounds did he mention that at the time? Clearly, if he thought that wasn't the case, he was just speaking rhetorically, in which case it's just empty words.
I guess this is crippling for athletics in general as well, because it's not the first time that we've mentioned on this show doping allegations. There was the incident surrounding Paula Radcliffe earlier this year as well. Is this going to become like cycling, and that there might be just no way back, and no one can ever trust athletics again in fair competition?
Do you know what? I can hear the pips. So I'm going to say yes, but also it extends further onto other sports as well, because football could well be connected to the 2018 World Cup, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And we heard about Arsene Wenger saying that we'd be amazed to think that football was clean as well. We will be talking a bit of football later on in the show, but let's get into a little bit of rugby as well. As Sam Burgess, the man who made the switch from rugby league to rugby union, participated under Stuart Lancaster's England side in the World Cup this year, has decided to leave Bath and go back to rugby league. Mike Ford, saying the Bath coach, saying that Burgess didn't have the stomach to battle for a place in union. Burgess just saying that his heart wasn't in playing rugby union. He wants to go back to league. Gentlemen, do we feel a bit sorry for Sam Burgess? Do we feel sorry for Bath Rugby Rugby Club? Do we think that Mike Ford has a point, that Burgess should have stood his ground and fought for a place in rugby union?
Do you know what's interesting about this, Ollie? Is that they waited until wheels were up on his flight from the UK to Australia to then come out and say he didn't have the stomach for rugby union. Yeah, very well judged there, Bath. Well done. I do feel for him. He was put in an incredibly difficult position. It was a very, very short period of time. I think if he was going to have a proper stab at it, if you like, perhaps they should have blooded him earlier. I'd like to see more of him in the Six Nations, perhaps. But you know, for him to come in and play at a crucial position that is sort of dictated by instinct, more so than sort of thought, I think that's very difficult when you're switching codes. So, I mean, I still think that, you know, we could have hopefully seen more of him and given him another run later. But it was perhaps a short-sighted call from Stuart Lancaster to put him in at that point and expect results, you know, in terms of, you know, him playing in the Rugby World Cup and being a success.
So you believe Lancaster is partly to blame for Burgess making the switch back to league now as well, because he was had too much pressure put on him too early, much as we've heard Sordell talking about young footballers, for instance, as well recently.
I think he has to sort of, I suppose, take some responsibility for that. Yeah, but then it's up to the player. I mean, you know, he has the option. He still had a contract at Bath. He could have carried on and tried to tough it out. But, you know, he knows what he loves. He was with the New Zealand Warriors. He's decided to go back to that part of the world and join the South Sydney Rabbitohs. And, you know, he's got family over there. I think he's feeling like a little bit vulnerable right now, Sam Burgess, and needs a little bit of kind of, you know, someone to take care of him and look after him for a bit. And so he's gone back to what he knows, and that's fair enough.
Exactly. I totally agree with David there. I think it's the vulnerability of what he's feeling at the moment, because let's not make any bones about this. Burgess has been made a scapegoat for what happened to England at the World Cup. Now, there are other scapegoats involved, Lancaster included, of course. But I think with such focus put on Burgess because he was changing code, he wasn't a rugby union player, it just meant that the extra pressure that's been put on him has made his mind up for him. If he wasn't thinking about changing now, all the treatment and the focus that he got during the tournament and post-tournament ultimately made his decision for him that maybe this wasn't for him. And when you're in a situation like that, you always want to go back to what you know.
What does he go back to rugby league as then? How do you think he's going to be viewed by the rugby league community?
It's a difficult one. I mean, myself based in Leeds and speaking to Rhinos fans, there is a bit of animosity towards players who have the temerity to want to switch codes as if they're going to play in a better game. A lot of the time, though, can be simply financial to try and earn more cash out of what is essentially a reasonably short career. And there's only so long you can play rugby for and take the hits. And some players want to maximise what they can get out of the game in that short period of time. And I don't think they can be criticised wholly for that.
I still feel a little sorry for Bath Rugby Club as well, though. The fact that they put this investment into Burgess and they still were leaving him a place to fight for, and he's just turned his back on them. I think it is a little harsh on Mike Ford and Bath Rugby Club. We will move away, but we'll stay with the hard-hitting. We're going to talk a little bit of American football and hard-hitting athletes in general. Wes Welker this week joining up with the St. Louis Rams after being a free agent to start this season in the NFL. Now, Welker is one of those players that's had numerous hits to the head, 3 concussions in 9 months during 2013 and 2014. And there's been an article in USA Today talking about how should somebody be saving Wes Welker from himself, if you will, going back into the game? Gentlemen, we had the incident with Hugo Lloris as well recently in the Premier League and in football, and it's been a hot topic of conversation. Players get taking too many head injuries. Do they sometimes just have to be stopped from damaging themselves in sport, these athletes?
Do you know what? It's a tough one because, you know, they're doing something they love. It's their passion. They want to be out there on the field of play, sure. But I think it's been brought into really sharp focus through a number of other things, not just in American football, not just in British football, in association football, if you like, but also in cricket with Philip Hughes. And anything that's to do with a head injury now just has that sort of real weight about it. It has that real sensitivity about it. I wonder who is advising him. I mean, especially after the number of hits that Wes has taken in particular. Mm. I mean, is he not getting the message? I would be concerned. And also, it doesn't affect just him, but affects people around him, affects his teammates, affects his family. You know, it can do untold damage. It's like a boxer who just doesn't want to give up going in for more punishment. I think, yeah, maybe they do need to be told that they need to stop.
We've seen changes in sport take place, for instance, in the NFL. If there's any potential of a concussion down on the pitch, the referees can send a player off. We've seen change as well in football too. How far should it go where medical almost interference comes in with athletes then in these sorts of situations?
Well, it comes down to, in my opinion, the legal ramifications of allowing someone to do this. I noticed this week in the US press that footballers under the age of 10, soccer players under the age of 10 in the US are going to be prohibited from heading the ball because of the possibility of concussion cases for these kids further down the line and potential lawsuits. Now, that regulation to me seems a bit crazy considering the weight of a football versus the weight of a quarterback.
It's really strange, isn't it, Paul? I mean, you know, don't you need to teach someone how to head the ball as well? I mean, that's where they pick up the skills, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a fundamental difference between a quarterback getting absolutely rinsed and sacked in a game versus somebody heading the ball off a wall. A fundamental difference here, but ultimately it comes down to dollars in a lot of these decisions, and they're just hedging their bets and making sure that they don't have a similar case to the one that the NFL are currently having to deal with.
Here's another thing, though. What happens if kids don't head the ball? What will they do? They'll attack the ball with their feet. What happens then? Probably get injured. I mean, you know, you need to kind of give them the confidence that they can head a ball properly and that they're not going to do themselves any, you know, any damage, rather than just sort of ban it and only have it in games in certain age groups. It, to me, personally, just my opinion, it's crazy.
Yeah, plus, if the player doesn't know how to jump and head the ball correctly and normally, then they'll start to do it in unconventional manners, which means elbows are out, which means legs are up, which means inevitably more injuries when jumping for headers once they hit 11, 12, 13. To me, it just seems a bit protective when it's not necessary. But I think it's ultimately linked to this NFL case. I think everybody's being scared off by the potential lawsuits, the potential revenue that the NFL are going to have to pay out for these historical cases.
Do we feel sorry at all for players who feel they have to keep going back because an athlete's career is so short?
I think they've got to take responsibility for their own careers. And, you know, I think someone has to step in. If it's got to that point, especially with Wes, my view is someone needs to be talking to him. And I wonder how well he's been advised right now.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens when Wes Welker returns this weekend. We're going to take a look back at last weekend, the Rome Derby in Serie A. It's always a key fixture in the league campaign, and always one that everybody loves to watch and enjoy, not just because of the football on the pitch, but because of what happens in the stands as well. The choreography, the flares, the atmosphere. That was all gone, though, this weekend, as the two sets of ultras from Roma and Lazio deciding to not come to the game. They followed the teams to the stadium, but didn't actually take their seats, went and watched the game elsewhere due to a protest against increased security measures at Serie A football that they feel is sucking the life out of the game in Italy. I want to start this one off, gentlemen, with first and foremost, do we agree with the ultras to any extent that them being denied the ability to kind of create this choreography takes a huge element away from the game?
I think it's a difficult one. There's a fine balance to be struck here between the sanitisation of the Premier League, and I don't mind using that word because I've attended quite a few matches in the Premier League recently, and there are a significant percentage of fans that arrive as day trippers to experience the match itself rather than support the team they're there to see. And in that environment, what you'll see in a lot of Premier League home games now involving Arsenal and Man United and to a certain extent Man City is that they are outsung by the away fans because it's the hardcore element of the support in the away end that's singing all the songs, whereas the home fans are there just to enjoy the day out a lot of the time. A certain percentage of them are anyway. Compare that with some of the incidents that's happened in Italian football recently, some deaths, stabbings, incidents like that, and surely there has to be a happy medium to be found in the middle of both of those environments.
Well, what I think is peculiar, though, is that you've got both sets of ultras uniting together in this protest. It shows that actually that they can be human beings to with each other and unite against almost a greater force, if you will.
Well, in a way, then they are making their point in, you know, a more adult and understandable way, isn't it? Because, you know, you put aside the political ideologies, put aside the violence that Paul was alluding to there. And, you know, these guys are passionate football fans. And, you know, I love seeing those shots of, you know, whether it be the San Siro or Stadio Alpi or, you know, wherever it might be, and seeing the colour, the real atmosphere, the choreography, as you said, Ollie. And it's funny because I was reading a couple of quotes about this, and there's a guy who's, I think, on local radio in that part of the world in Rome, who said to play the derby without the curva is like having a vegetarian Amitriana sauce with no tomato. It simply does not exist. Don't call it a derby. Oh, look, it's a derby. It's a derby. Just, you know, yes, slightly sanitized. I think they do need to find the middle ground. And it shows that if they can have that kind of peaceful protest, well, maybe there is more middle ground than they thought.
Are we impressed as well by the fact that they've been able to have this protest and it's actually made an impact, as opposed to when you see the protests against, for instance, away tickets at Arsenal from Man City fans and the walkouts that were intended to happen at St James's Park time and time again? Are we almost impressed that this one's actually made an impact and has been followed through on the biggest day, really, of this first half of the season for these two clubs?
Yes, to a certain extent. But what I would say, I'm not trying to compare cultures here between Germany and Italy, because I know they're completely different environments. But what I would say is the German Bundesliga matches are filled with choreography and passionate support. And there isn't the same level of regulation against them, because the off-the-field events that have happened in Italy simply haven't happened in Germany. Therefore, there is no need to regulate it as consistently. So, yes, I do feel a certain degree of sympathy for them. But one isolated incident where they've shared their stand doesn't mean that these incidents are now gone forever.
It is very much, I guess, as we alluded to, there's two separate cultures between these two footballing clubs and their fans, and it's never going to mix perfectly. But I was kind of impressed that they were both able to... I'd be the first person to go back into the ground and be like, actually, I'm not missing this one. Not in a heartbeat. Not the Rome derby. We'll move away from last weekend and look ahead to this weekend. Thursday sees Norway taking on Hungary. Friday sees Bosnia against Ireland. And Saturday sees Ukraine against Slovenia and Sweden against Denmark in the Euro 2016 playoffs. Gents, we're running out of time here, so our final topic of the day: which one of these games are we looking forward to the most? Are we going to pay much attention to the Euro playoffs, and will Ireland be able to get some luck finally after what happened against France?
I think they will. I think they've got a decent draw. Bosnia, well, cliche, you name any Central European country and then sort of insert that, not an easy place to go. But I think they will. Okay, they've got injuries and suspensions, but I think ultimately they probably have more togetherness as a team. I'd like to see them come back I'd like to see them come back with a positive result to Dublin on Monday. But the tie I'm really looking forward to is Sweden-Denmark. You know, you're actually used to seeing these teams at major tournaments back in the day, but now they've kind of fallen on slightly harder times. And Sweden, having not made the last World Cup, knows Zlatan, of course, made it no tournament not worth watching, apparently. And now they might not make the Euros. I think they might have a tricky one there at home to Denmark first.
It's quite an interesting one as well, because it's that almost the battle of Scandinavia, if you will. Obviously, it's going to be overlooked, I think, in the English press with the Bosnia-Ireland game. Sweden-Denmark, I personally don't know too much about whether there's a big rivalry between these two sides or not, but it's a tantalising tie in terms of proximity as well.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm not sure Denmark is sort of... Well, I mean, it is Scandinavia, but I'm not sure it's proper Scandinavia, is it? I don't know. I mean, it's more Finland and Norway, but yeah, I mean, there'll be something made of that, I'm sure, locally between those two countries. You know, and Denmark as well, with, you know, their history in this particular tournament, having, you know, come in for Yugoslavia all those years ago and then suddenly winning the title out of nowhere. I mean, you know, that is great. I'd like to see something just, you know, that would kind of recreate that moment or that atmosphere and that sort of importance between these two sides. So yeah, I think that it will be feisty, yeah, no doubt about that.
Paul, which
would be if you remember the Sweden versus Denmark game, which tournament was, escapes me, it might have been Euro 2004, where Sweden and Denmark drew two each in the last group game to eliminate Italy. There's still a lot of animosity between the countries. In fact, there's been incidents since then where a fan invaded the pitch and the match got abandoned. So I think that will very much be a feisty affair. But guys, let's face it, Scotland aren't going to be in it. So who really cares? I mean,
but you were so close. I was at the game against both of them, against Germany and Poland. Oh my goodness, my goodness.
Yeah, to be fair, any team
that does it on such a regular basis, it's the Scots, isn't it?
Well, the thing that frustrates me is there's going to be a lot of build-up for this Ireland game, and we took 4 points off them. This is not a good Ireland side. And it will depress me greatly if they get to a major tournament.
Is your money then on Bosnia, Paul? Is that what you're saying?
My heart will be on Bosnia, to be honest, rather than my money. So
unbelievable. I can't believe we got sidetracked into talking Scottish football as Ireland gets set to take on Bosnia and Herzegovina, looking to finally get back to a major football tournament. Gentlemen, we are out of time here on the show. David, a massive thank you for joining us here on the show this week.
No problem whatsoever. Absolute pleasure.
And Paul, I will catch up with you in a week's time as well, of course. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
We will be back next week in 7 days' time. Until then, enjoy the sport. Click us on iTunes. Have a good one.